Okay. Good morning. Hello again. Now we are going to hear about one of those topics that I think changes as fast as taxation laws, and there's not many of them. The digital afterlife. As you know, the way in which technology impacts on our lives changes and develops, the way in which it's going to impact on our death changes and develops just as fast. And Tracy Dunn is going to guide us through this. And I've been privileged to read a pre-conference version of her paper, and it is the most practical guide to navigating the digital afterlife. So definitely hang on to it and keep it. And please join me now to welcome Tracy. Oh, and sorry, we will have questions at the end of the session. Thank you.
Thanks, Julie. And this has to be the first time that I've done a presentation where my phone has actually been an important part of the presentation. So I don't bring my phone up here because I'm physically attached to it and, you know, have anxiety if I don't have it. It's because it's an important part of the whole presentation. And, you know, I look around and many people have the phones on their tables. They're using their phones. You'll all acknowledge that your phones and your smart devices are a really important part of your life. And in the past, we would have kept paper records in, you know, multi-level filing cabinets. Now, all of those records that we kept in these multi-level filing cabinets, we keep on our phone, which is great while we're alive, but it can cause all sorts of issues when we pass. And the presentation that I've put together today has something for everybody. So I'm going to ease you in with some of the issues for individuals. So these are things that will impact on you personally, possibly. Certainly impacts on me as I had to reflect while I was researching and writing the paper. And it might impact on your clients when it comes to succession planning purposes. So whilst not only dealing with how they're going to pass their assets when they pass, it's actually being able to identify and access those assets and records that they need, which might be quite challenging. Then I'm going to move through some issues that are more for the lawyers in the room, so just some particular challenges that have arisen and considerations in certain jurisdictions, or particularly New South Wales and Victoria, and perhaps some legacy issues for Queensland that arose from the changes to during, you know, the COVID lockdown time that allowed for people to witness wills electronically. There has been some case law in this space, both in Queensland and Victoria, that highlights some particular challenges that perhaps people didn't turn their mind to when they were thinking, well, this is a great way that that we can witness wills, ensure people have their wills in place before they pass in uncertain times. But there's been some particular challenges the way the law has worked, or perhaps hasn't worked, that now means that some wills may not actually be valid. And then I'm going to go through some quickly just about some challenges with certifying digital documents, and then I'm going to focus a large part on issues around digital assets and cryptocurrency and some of the tax issues that come about from that might impact on LPRs and executors, quite an uncertain space. So first I'd like to thank particularly Harmony and Julie for reaching out to me to write this paper. When I first got the call from Julie and she started talking about digital probate, I'm like, oh, no, that's not my space. I'm tax, not succession. Albeit that, you know, I might be advising my clients on, you know, structuring for succession, but I don't deal with actual, you know, succession law issues with probate. And then when Julie started describing what the issues were that they were asking me to consider if I was to agree to present a paper, I'd actually been looking at some of these issues from a different perspective. So I actually had a digital document. It was a graduate diploma of legal practice that was only issued in digital form, and I needed a certified copy. And just at that time that Julie called me, I'm thinking, well, how do you certify a digital document that's not been issued in original form? And these are issues as we move more and more towards digital that practitioners, whether they be lawyers or accountants, need to be turning their mind to if documents are need to be certified and they're only issued in digital form, what are the particular requirements that you need to satisfy in order to certify the document, or can you do it at all? So fun times ahead for the next hour. First, accessing online accounts. How many of you use two-factor authentication on your phones? So how many of you have turned your mind, and you don't have to put your hand up, to what happens if you pass and your executor, your LPR needs to access your bank account information, other accounts, if they're relying on two-factor authentication and you have a passcode on your phone that they don't know, or you have passwords on your desktop computer that they don't know, they might not be able to access SMS on your phone. It might pop up with a message on the front of the screen, but if you can't actually access the phone, how do you then use two-factor authentication to access this digital data? You might not be able to. You might need to take steps to actually go to a bank or go to whatever corporate entity it is that you need a document to be able to access the information that you need. So two-factor authentication, accessing things like email, that you would, things that we rely on, we just take for granted every day. So I have my email accounts. My alerts pop up. If I forget my password, I go reset the password and go through the two-factor authentication process to reset my password. But I rely on my smart devices to be able to do that. Now, I had a circumstance just recently where somebody reached out from the US. Their husband had passed unexpectedly. Husband was an Australian citizen, so it was an expat. When they had moved from Australia to the US, had changed phones, so they had an Australian number, or he had an Australian number, and that Australian number was connected with, his two-factor authentication that was tied to particular accounts in Australia. She didn't have access to that phone. And her question was, I need to access this information and I need to access these accounts, but I only have the US phone number. So what do I do? I couldn't answer that question. I referred her on to some succession lawyers to assist with her challenges in administering her husband's estate. But this is actually a real issue that people are facing. So with your email accounts, you may or may not have turned your mind to what happens to the content in your email accounts, particularly your personal email accounts, when you pass. And one of the things that I think you'll take away from this session is the importance of reading the terms and conditions, because they're all different depending on, platforms and providers. So if you're using things like Google, you can actually set Google up. So if you're using Google Docs, you're using Google Mail, you might be using other Google apps, you can actually set up your account with an inactive account manager. So you can set it up so that if your account is inactive for a certain period of time, it will send an email and an access code to a particular individual that you've given authority to say, hey, this account has been inactive for a certain period of time. Now, that might be for a number of reasons. It might be that somebody's just decided that they want a break from digital life. It might be that they've been incapacitated in a certain way, or it might be that they have actually passed. Now, if they've passed and turning to that, those you need to access those documents for some reason or access those accounts, if your clients or you have set up an inactive account manager and you've nominated a particular person with particular authority to deal with certain things with, it might be that you have authority just to be able to deal with Google on your behalf, and that might be to close accounts down, not to actually access the content. Or it might be that you've given authority for the person that he's nominated under that inactive account manager to do things with your account and access your content. So that's an actual really important consideration for people. I will say I have a Google account and I haven't set up an inactive account manager, but I'll certainly be considering it from after having done the research for this paper. Similarly, with Apple, I use my phone for everything, but with Apple, you can set up with certain variations of the operating system, so it's the latter operating systems, you can set up a legacy contact, similar to the Google Inactive Account Manager, but with the legacy contact, again, you can set it up with certain approvals for a person to deal with Apple and your account in certain ways. If you don't have that, there might be circumstances where Apple will deal with a legal personal representative or a member of the immediate family to reset an Apple ID, but not guaranteed. And if they do agree to reset the Apple ID, then all the data that, once it's reset, the data that was on that account will be gone. So you won't be able to use it with another device. And also with passcodes. I've certainly had this with one of my adult children when she was in the latter part of her teens. Terrible. She'd just go through phones like toilet paper. She broke her phone and broke her iPad, which was connected to her Apple ID. And then she just didn't have the phone for some period of time because mum wouldn't buy her another one. Then eventually she got another phone, but she couldn't remember her passcode. I can tell you that the hassle that I had to go through with Apple to actually get her Apple ID reactivated was an absolute nightmare, and it took about 2 months before they actually reset it. No guarantee that that was going to happen. And if you think that, you know, this is an issue that can happen on death as well, is that people forget their they don't forget their password. They're just gone. You can't get it. So these are really practical things that I think that we don't take the time to step aside and really think about. Okay, well, what happens if I pass? Does anyone know the passcode on my phone? Do people know? Is there somebody important that has access to my emails? Now, I've been to conferences where people have run cybersecurity sessions, and these wonderfully intelligent people have criticised older people such as myself, saying their parents, who are of my vintage, are a horrendous cybersecurity risk because they use the same passcodes on everything, or they use the same passwords on everything, and sometimes because they can't remember their 13 letter number symbol password, they write it down and put it in the notes on their phone. So we have these complications that we need to think of. So my kids, if for some reason I passed unexpectedly, my kids would be able to access my phone, and they would then be able to access my computer and whatever they would need to deal with my estate, because I'm really terrible with that stuff and they can just work it out. So these are really important things. And things like Facebook and Instagram, for the people that continue to use it, even if it's a member of your family, The privacy rules, and Yahoo Mail, for example, they're really strict with their privacy. And if a member of the family or an LPR, all they can do with Yahoo, for example, is shut the account. They will not, under any circumstances, give somebody else access to your email. Similar with Facebook. You can go in and set up a similar legacy contact with Facebook so that, you know, somebody will have specific authority to either give instructions to Facebook to delete or memorialise your account and or access the content. But other than that, very, very difficult to get Facebook to agree to delete or memorialise an account. They will, if there's no authority, they will not grant anybody authority to access the content. They do say that in certain circumstances they will consider it if there is a court order. But if they're not a party to that court order, they do specifically say on their website, well, we may still not give you access. So, you know, these things that are just a part of our everyday lives, the things that we don't think about twice when we pick up our phone and, you know, we want a distraction from real life and we're flicking through what somebody's doing on Facebook or Instagram, can actually become a real problem when we pass, especially, you know, where people pass in, you know, difficult circumstances, and there's this, somebody is dealing with a lot of grief, and this is quite often with families who lose, you know, children, adult children. And they're reminded, you know, they come up with birthday reminders each year. People can tag the deceased person in posts. You have no control over that, and it can be really traumatic for people. So these are things that, you know, this is a death and taxes conference, and I usually only talk about tax, but researching and writing this paper made me really take a step back and think about just the ordinary things that I do and we all do on a day-to-day basis, and what steps that we need to do to make those things easier for people when we pass. So, moving away from that rather heavy topic, I'll move on to another one that's completely different: remote witnessing of documents. Now, surprisingly enough, I'm of an era that, I remember using an old Gestetner to copy things and, having to go to a phone box if you needed to call someone. Or in some cases, when there was no phone box, you just wrote letters and waited for a few weeks until somebody got it and then wrote back to you. And, you know, now we have this digital age that makes life so much easier, and it was wonderful, in 2020 when, so many people were being locked down. It meant that we could move to this online world and do a lot of things in an online environment that otherwise we had to do in person. And with the uncertainty and the high death rates in 2020, that some state governments, not WA, moved to enabling, these important documents like powers of attorney and wills to be witnessed remotely, which was fantastic because it gave some people, you know, certainty, particularly if they were extremely unwell. They might have been in situations that because of restrictions on people being able to, be in the same room together, that you could give some certainty in respect to your estate without the normal formalities. But this has become, there's some particular challenges there that I think that legislators perhaps didn't turn their mind to, and people who were witnessing documents didn't turn their mind to, which was actually considered in a Victorian case, which I'll get to. So temporary measures, New South Wales, yes, and that's become permanent through the Electronic Transactions Act. Victoria, temporary measures expired in April 2021, but have been made permanent specifically within the Wills Act and the Power of Attorney Act. There might be others, but I don't live in Victoria, so I'll leave those in Victoria to research themselves. Queensland did, but those temporary measures expired on July 2021. Tasmania and ACT and Northern Territory, no. South Australia and Western Australia had some temporary measures, but not in relation to wills. And now New South Wales and Victoria are the only states that have ongoing permanent measures for electronic witnessing of wills. The New South Wales legislation, I actually, when I was researching the paper, I thought was quite good, because they did actually change, they embedded the change in the Electronic Transactions Act, and they inserted Section 12H, which provides clarity on the meaning of an original document, and also, you know, address particular issues about where something was witnessed by a person who was outside of the state, which is, you know, if something is supposed to be executed in a state, is it executed in a state if one of the witnesses actually isn't in that state? So, you know, things that people generally not really turning their mind to. And the place of execution when it is executed remotely. So that's some really good clarity in the New South Wales Act. Victoria have I've already mentioned that there's been changes. So it's the remote execution procedure is actually set out in the Wills Act, and it requires one of the witnesses to be a special witness, so that's a lawyer. All of the elements of the remote execution procedure must be carried out on the same day within Victoria. The testator must sign the will with all witnesses clearly seeing the signature being made by auto-visual link. And I emphasise that for a reason, which we'll get to, or a combination of physical presence and audio-visual link. If the witness is physically present when the testator signs, they must sign the will in accordance with the usual requirements under the Act. Special witness must sign last. And then there's some rules around electronic communication. Now, a couple of cases that have dealt with some issues around remote execution. So, Ree Curtis, so this is a relatively recent Victorian Supreme Court case, and this was a case where the will was executed remotely, and the plaintiff, who was making an application for a grant of probate, was in the same house as the testator when they were signing the will. And the special witness was remote, and another witness was remote, and they used DocuSign to sign the will electronically. Now, I found this case, the judgment, really interesting, but I'm a nerd. So whether or not you find it interesting, because it really, they used, there were friends of the court who assisted the court in understanding some of the particular challenges around the digital aspects of electronic signing of a will. And in Ree Curtis, the will was found not to be signed in accordance with the remote execution procedures. There was some particular challenge there. And it was invalid, but it was still admitted as an informal will. But importantly, in Ree Curtis, the judge said that whilst he or she would admit the will in this particular case, in this particular circumstance, that wouldn't always be the case. So where practitioners or people had, you know, clients or their own wills that had been signed remotely, either through the under the temporary measures or with the new permanent measures, they should reflect and consider whether or not those wills were actually executed in accordance with the provisions. Now, the particular issue with Ree Curtis was that, now, the testator was in a room and he did have two laptops set up. So there was one laptop that had the will that was visible on the screen, and they were using DocuSign. The other laptop was used for Zoom or whatever other platform was used, you know, for the people to dial in, so that the people who were visually watching him sign could see the other laptop. One of the particular challenges in Ree Curtis was being with using DocuSign was the question of, there was two issues. Firstly, is witnessing a cursor, that is navigating to a yellow tab that says sign here, even though you can see somebody else in the same room, is that witnessing the testator signing the original document? Because what you're witnessing, technically, is a cursor on a screen that is inserting a digital signature in a box. So that's issue one. Issue two was around whether or not it was the same document. Because with DocuSign, and this was the court said there was not enough information, you know, to understand how the DocuSign technology worked to determine whether it was the same document, because as we all know, we all use DocuSign. One person signs, and then that automatically triggers an email to another person that says, sign the document. So is that the same document, or is it a version of the same document? So it's a technical point, but it's really important from a, you know, these considerations in the digital age. So you would think it's the same document because, well, it's got the same words on it, but is it the same document when it's being transmitted to multiple different people in a, you know, a fractional different time? So the court said that it potentially wasn't, or it wasn't the same document based on the information that was before the court. So if you have your clients, New South Wales is a little different because it does actually define what is an original document. And I think that the legislation is flexible enough to cover things like DocuSign. But, it, you know, other jurisdictions, you might need to look back and say, well, was this will signed using DocuSign? With the video of, you know, the recording of the person signing the will, is that sufficient to demonstrate that it was the same document, or that you witnessed the testator signing the document as opposed to seeing a cursor on a screen? So these are interesting considerations. And in Ri Sheehan, similar but not the same, this was a will that was signed electronically under the temporary provisions in Queensland. The regulations required that all pages be signed. There was a couple of pages that weren't signed. And again, it was determined to be an invalid will, but it was, it was invalid, but it was admitted as an informal will. No guarantee that that would be the same case in every circumstance. And an important consideration, you know, certainly something that I learnt through this process, is that if the will is invalid, then the question of the capacity of the testator comes into question as well. And in both Ri Sheehan and Ri Curtis, the judge in the respective jurisdictions was able to form the view from watching the recording of the signing and the behaviour of the testator and the words that were used, that the testator in each particular case did have capacity. So, fun times. certification of digital documents. I have touched on this and I'm not going to spend much time on it, other than to say there's no uniform law or approach. Every state is different. In New South Wales, surprisingly, even though New South Wales is really advanced when it comes to digitisation, you know, with their digital licences and, you know, keep your whole life on your phone, they take a bit of a vibe approach when it comes to, you know, how you can certify a digital document. It's kind of, oh, just check with the person that, you know, wants the document and whatever they say is fine. Whereas in South Australia, for example, there's, am I correct, Julie, that it's only a JP that can...
It's JPs and lawyers, but there's an issue with whether it's the whether you're actually seeing the document to certify.
Yeah, and there's in particular in the JP, you know, guidelines in South Australia where it talks about that a document will be taken to be a certified copy of an original, a digital document, where you go to the place that actually generated the digital document and the document has to be generated by an officer at that place, that officer has to be satisfied that it is an original copy of one of their documents and has to apply their seal that it is in fact an original. Or you can go down the path of a statutory declaration. Tasmania, again, statutory declaration, they take the view that you can't have an original of a digital document because if you print it out, it's just a copy. So some particular challenges there. In the paper, I have summarised what the current position is in each state. So I have written the paper in a way that hopefully assists people in all jurisdictions of, you know, when these particular issues come up, where they need to look to find out, you know, what they need to do. So on to one of my favourite topics, digital assets. I'm sure that there's lots of people in the room that may be going, my clients don't have digital assets, this isn't really relevant to me. I suspect that there are plenty of clients that you have that have digital assets, particularly cryptocurrency, that just haven't told you. I was saying before, I was chatting over at the table, that I was having a conversation with somebody earlier this year. So I was presenting for the Tax Institute on the Gold Coast on digital assets. And I was helping this client with a residence issue. And we were just chatting, having a friendly chat. And I was saying, oh, I'm away next week. I'm going to the Gold Coast presenting on digital assets. And she's like, oh, I've got cryptocurrency. Do you need to know about that? And I'm like, yes, we do. And the number of times that I've had team members that have come to me and, you know, shown me an ATO pre-fail report. Now, they've sent a request to their clients and asked, do you have digital assets? And they say, no. And then you get a pre-fill report that says your client has had cryptocurrency transactions this year. So there's a lot of confusion out there as to, you know, the visibility of the tax office over cryptocurrency assets, the taxation of those assets, and what happens with assets on death. Now, there's some particular issues that I want to cover from a deceased estate's perspective. Particularly, now this area is really, really uncertain because we have people who use wallets and I do have props, although they're really small. People who use wallets, and it might be a hard wallet, which that's a hard wallet. It might be a software wallet, so either an app on the phone or it's supported by something that's on your desktop computer. From an estate's perspective, So they might be using a wallet, so they do wallet-to-wallet transactions, or they might have an account on a digital currency exchange. Now, we need to think about different considerations from a digital perspective with each one of those. So I'm just going to I'm going to step away from the mic for just a second for the people that are online. And the reason is because I have this really tiny little thing in my hand, and I've held it up before, and because I have a dark top on that people haven't seen it. So it's rather small. And if you have clients that you're doing succession planning for and they say, I've got significant cryptocurrency and digital assets, I have assets that are recorded against my wallet, I have assets that are on a digital currency exchange. Now, I can't actually tell you the answer to this. So these are just considerations that you know that you need to take into account. If they want to make specific gifts of assets, we have some challenges that we need to work through before we work out whether or not something can be subject of can be a gift under a will. Firstly, I don't know how many in the people in the room know that when you have a hard wallet. Or a software wallet, there's no identifying features against this other than your private and public key, which is a long string of numbers, letters and symbols. So this, there's no digital assets stored on this. It's a key. So this gives you the power to change a record on the blockchain, dealing with whatever asset it is that you happen to have. So this is just a key. Nothing's stored on this wallet. But without this key that has your private and public key, you can't deal with the records that are in relation to the cryptocurrency or digital assets that you hold. So when you have a wallet, it is your key, but one of the considerations from, this is just every day, but specifically from a deceased estate's succession planning perspective, you need to be able to demonstrate whose asset it is. And I've had conversations with people who say, it's my money, but it's my girlfriend's wallet. And that might be a high wealth person whose girlfriend has a low marginal tax rate. Or it might be easier for people to use a single wallet address, but multiple people may have contributed the funds which have been used to purchase assets. So it may be that you have a couple, two spouses, that have joint assets. Well, how do you demonstrate it's a joint asset? You're going to need documentation, because this will provide you with nothing other than a public and private key. And when you buy one of these, and you can't buy them in brick and mortar stores, the hard wallets, they can only come from the manufacturer or a authorised online reseller. You might give your name then, but there's nothing identified with this. And with the digital app that is on my computer and my phone, there is absolutely nothing that has my name, my details, nothing that identifies that this belongs to me. And that's really important, because potentially you could have challenges down the track where people say, well, the crypto assets that are associated with this wallet don't belong to the deceased. They belong to someone else. And, you know, this is something that's going to be an issue in the future. The other issue, and this is a more complicated one, and I'm not going to get into the whole question of is cryptocurrency property, because it's my understanding, my belief, it's the intention of the Australian government that it will be property. And if, you know, there's ever a case that challenges that legislation will change, because there's issues in equity if it's not property, particularly from a deceased estate's family law perspective. So setting that aside, if we make the assumption that it is property, if I transact with the public and private key that is on this little thing, which I don't, by the way, because it's too hard to use, and I lost enough money, I don't want to lose anymore. So if I transact using the public and private key on that, I can say that's my property and I can deal with it. So if I had records that say I own one Bitcoin or 10 Bitcoin or whatever, and it was associated with this public and private key, I could say, well, that's my property, assuming it's property. But if I transact using a digital currency exchange, and I'm going to hand this to Julie. So Julie's just established the Julie Digital Currency Exchange, and she's providing digital currency exchange services to the general public. She has her own privately owned company. And the terms of the arrangement are set out in the terms and conditions of the use of the platform. But how a digital currency exchange works is that I take my fiat currency, or might be, you know, cryptocurrency that I have on a wallet, and I send it to Julie, but to her wallet address. So if you all then decide, I want to get in on this stuff, and Julie's offering a really great product, I'm going to use her digital currency exchange, and then you transfer money to your account, and you transact, the terms of the transaction, the terms of the relationship, the contract between you and Julie are set out in the separate terms of use. But your crypto assets that you purchase will all be recorded against that digital currency exchange wallet address. So there's a real question over whose property is it? Now, this issue has been considered in, as far as I'm aware, one international jurisdiction. So that was in Hong Kong in Reed Gatecoin. Now, in Reed Gatecoin, it was a liquidation issue, and the liquidator made an application to the court to determine, you know, for the question to be determined whether or not the crypto assets that were held by Reed Gatecoin on behalf of account users belonged to the account users, so if they were held on trust, or there was just a creditor relationship. Now, the answer to that was in the T&Cs, because before 2018, the T&Cs actually said that the platform held the assets under a custodial arrangement on behalf of the users. So the court, applying certain legal principles, decided that even though the assets, you know, were intermingled, you know, that they were fungible, that the terms and conditions indicated that there was a custodial arrangement and there was a trust. But what often happens with these platforms is that they change the terms and conditions. And it's one of the terms and conditions that they can change the terms and conditions. And in respect to Reed Gatecoin, they changed the conditions in 2018. And it caused a pop-up to come up, you know, on people's apps to say, I acknowledge that the terms and conditions have changed, and then people continued to transact. Some did, some didn't. The terms and conditions, the new terms and conditions, did not use language around custodial services. So the court decided that those assets, the accounts that had been transacted on post-2018 with the new terms and conditions, there was no trust. So there was just a creditor relationship. It wasn't property of the account holder, so the crypto assets. But pre-2018, for those people who had cryptocurrency sitting on the platform, then they were still, the terms of their account were still under the pre-2018 terms and conditions, because they'd taken no step, they hadn't used the platform, and they hadn't clicked the button to say they accepted the change in terms and conditions. Which raises the question that when we have clients who have cryptocurrency assets, and I was looking at one, you know, just this week, Monday, where there was a taxpayer who had significant holdings of crypto assets, quite sophisticated. She was doing wallet-to-wallet transactions. And when you do wallet-to-wallet transactions, you can, through the desktop app, you can download a CSV. And what you get is a CSV that has the date of the transaction. It has the public key of the originating wallet, so all you have is this long string of numbers, letters and symbols, and the wallet address of the target wallet, which is a long string of numbers, letters and symbols. And then you have the value and the type of crypto asset that was, you know, moved across these wallet addresses. But there is absolutely no way at all to determine who owned any of those wallets. So from a deceased estate perspective, that becomes really problematic. You've got the first issue of determining whose asset is it. Then you've got the second issue of actually accessing the records. And then you've got the third issue from a tax perspective, and this goes to you know, the panel session yesterday talking about, you know, the risks for executors. If you don't know whose asset it is, and it's going to take you a considerable amount of time to determine when there's been a disposal and to work out the cost base of the particular assets that have been transacted with, there could be this sleeping tax liability that could take a number of years to actually crystallise, or not crystallise, work out. And this, you know, this particular taxpayer where I was assisting the team in understanding the transactions also had some really complicated things. So there was a platform that provides loan funds. They allow you to leverage against your crypto assets. So you transfer crypto assets onto this platform, and then they allow you to borrow against those. And I suspect that they're actually using the crypto assets in their wallet to, you know, for staking or whatever else to generate a source of income from themselves, and they pay interest. So then you've got these questions around, you know, from a tax perspective. So consider that that taxpayer passed and the executor LPR is trying to work out where the assets are and what the tax liabilities are. You then have to go again to the terms and conditions, because you have to work out what were the terms under which the assets were transferred to the account, and what happens when the assets come off. And this leads me to the next issue of... well, that's not that one, but we'll get to that. It's the issue around, getting access to the cryptocurrency assets that are on a digital currency exchange. Again, we go back to the terms and conditions. And to save you all some time, and because I really need to get a life, I spent a lot of time reading the terms and conditions of multiple digital currency exchanges to see how they dealt with the rights of a account holder on their death. And four key ones, so SwiftX makes no reference to the passing of an account holder. The definition of you is pretty much confined to you. It doesn't include any reference to an LPR or executor or any other personal representative. Does not provide any conditions for assignments of rights that are in respect to that account. It does not give any guidance as to what happens, you know, to the account of a deceased user. CoinSpot is that actually in the definition of you also refers to executor or LPR. So that gives some comfort that where people are using that particular platform, that they will be able to deal with the platform on the passing of the account holder. And Coinbase is similar, so that also uses language around an LPR and executor in the definitions of you. Binance was the most advanced that I came across, because that actually has a whole section on the death of an account user and the processes. But when you go to that, you then have to consider how those terms and conditions apply and whether or not you can actually instruct the platform to transfer an account holder's digital assets to an external wallet, and whether that triggers a tax consequence, or whether they will not transfer the assets and they have to be realised into a fiat currency and then transferred into a bank account, which means that if somebody's attempted to make a specific gift under a will in respect to digital currency assets that are sitting on an exchange, there's a question about whether or not a specific gift can be made. But I'll leave that to the really smart people in the room, like Frank, to deal with. So, sorry to create more problems for you, Frank. So there's some real issues there that people need to work through, which gives me a segue into the last part of of my presentation about accessing tax records of a deceased. So if what I haven't talked about so far today hasn't been complicated enough, I'll just wrap it all up with something even more complicated, and that is being able to access the tax records of a deceased. So in the past. There was, a quirk in the system where we could continue to access, the tax records of somebody who passed through the portal. That was actually, it shouldn't have happened. And the tax office fixed that. They fixed the issue so that that the law was complied with, but it created a problem for practitioners. So when a person passes, any authority that they have given you as a practitioner, as a tax practitioner, ceases. Your access to their records on the portal should stop, because the tax office actually doesn't have authority to provide you with access, which is challenging. So there was a change that was made via legislative instrument that enables the tax office to provide you with some information. So they can provide an LPR with 3 years of information, but that's not necessarily going to be too helpful. So that is in relation to pre-death tax records. And Julie was saying to me that sometimes the tax office actually, there can be some challenges with an LPR seeking, obtaining those records from the tax office where they don't have a grant of probate, because in some circumstances they may not need one. And if the tax office won't release that information without the grant of probate, it means that it adds an additional burden on the LPR, who otherwise wouldn't be required to get a grant of probate, to go through that process. So there can be some real timing issues here about being able to access these historical tax records to be able to deal with outstanding compliance. And then we have the issue with, this isn't so much an issue, although it would be great if the whole thing was changed, or the law was changed to make it easier just for us to continue to access all records. So the post-date of death tax records, so when the LPR is appointed, they need to give instructions to appoint the tax agent again. And then from that point, the tax agent will have access to the post-death tax records through the portal, but not pre-death tax records. It's a bit of a mouthful. So administering deceased estates from a tax perspective can actually be quite challenging. And then if we then take a step back to, the challenges that I was talking about with digital assets and identifying whose assets they are and what are the particular tax consequences, what are the terms and conditions with each of the platforms that people are using. I don't know why anyone would want to be an executor, because I wouldn't. And we've got a couple of minutes left, so maybe are there any questions, Julie?
We have no questions online.
Oh.
Probably just showing my ignorance here, but with the whose property is it, were you suggesting that if it's the terms and conditions are such that it's not held on a trust for you, that and you're just making a loan, that it's not a CGT asset of yours and so the discount wouldn't apply?
Potentially.
Yeah.
But that issue, I'm all about creating issues, not solutions. It hasn't been considered from an Australian tax perspective, but it's certainly one that could arise. Any other questions? Well, if there's no other questions, I will hand back to Julie.
Thank Tracy very much for her presentation. I think that was fantastic, although I must say, if she knew how very, very ignorant I am of everything to do with digital assets, she'd never have had me managing an exchange. But that aside, it was great. As I said, it's really practical. So please complete your evaluation forms. And we just have a few minutes until our next session starts, talking about the administration of estates. Thank you.
that first.
Do you think that worked okay?
Yeah. Well, are you both, will you kind of be interacting with each other? I assume so. So yeah, I reckon. And I'll just introduce from the lectern.
Yeah. I'll say
both of you, and then you can give me a little blurb. Well, you can say all of that. I'll just say, Peter and Lynn are here, and you can.
Sure. Okay.
I figure if you two sit there,